Well, our third speaker is Dr. Robin McLeod. She is the Angelo Alfredo de Gasperis Families Chair in Colorectal Cancer and IBD Research in the Departments of Surgery and Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the University of Toronto. She's the surgical lead of the Quality Improvement and Knowledge Transfer Program in the Surgical Oncology Program of Cancer Care in Ontario. She's led several multi-center Canadian clinical trials in colorectal surgery, and today she'll share her experience with implementation with respect to enhanced recovery protocols in colorectal surgery. Robin.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you. It's nice to be here, and I appreciated the first two presentations. What I'm going to do is that over a couple of years, we implemented Enhanced Recovery After Surgery program at the University of Toronto Hospitals. And I'm going to show you what the framework that we used and sort of go through what we did with it. So the framework, I have no disclosure. So the framework that we use is what is called Knowledge to Action Cycle, or KTA. And it was developed by Ian Graham and his colleagues at Ottawa. And just as has been said is that they are very interested in evidence-based medicine, do quite a few trials, and recognize that once you have top evidence, level one evidence, that it may take up to 10 years to actually be adopted into care. So this is very similar to most other frameworks, but you can see in the middle of it that it is there's knowledge creation, and then on the outside implementation strategies. And as they say, that implementation and knowledge creation is sort of going back and forth. So by that meaning that we start off with good evidence, we may have to tailor the knowledge or come up with some more knowledge as we go along and implement it. So first of all, I'm going to talk about just the knowledge creation. And they characterize it in three steps. One, first generation knowledge, second, knowledge synthesis, and third, knowledge tools or products. And so the first generation knowledge is perhaps an early randomized control evidence from that, or just seeing that there's some new innovation. The knowledge synthesis, of course, is to put that all together in a systematic review or a meta-analysis. And then the knowledge tools or products are guidelines or care pathways. So in 2009, we actually started this a long time. We took a lot of time in doing this, but one of our residents did a meta-analysis of six randomized controlled trials. And you can see that, not surprisingly, that showed a decrease in 30-day morbidity and a decrease in length of stay. We then went on, though, and we developed a University of Toronto ERAS guideline. And the reason that we did that was because there's no sort of set guideline. And the guidelines that we saw, they had different things in them. And so we decided that we would do our own guideline. And you can see the various things that we included. And I'll talk about that just a little bit further. So then once we had done that, then we went on to implementation. And I want to just recognize that at the University of Toronto, we have eight big hospitals. We're a little bit different from other places is that we only have one medical school at the university in Toronto, the University of Toronto, and we have eight affiliated hospitals. And so we had involvement from all of those eight hospitals. Then actually, when we got to this stage, we actually got a grant from the province of Ontario. They have a granting agency to try and take things from knowledge into an implementation. So we got a grant. But with that, the proviso was that all academic hospitals in the province would be part of it. So we went from 8, which was quite a few, to 15 hospitals that were part of this. So the next part, the action cycle, the various steps are to adapt knowledge to local context, and we had developed the guideline, assess current status, assess barriers to knowledge use, select, tailor, and implement interventions, monitor knowledge use, evaluate outcomes, and sustain knowledge use. So I'm just going back, and I want to just talk about the guideline just a little bit more. And as I said, that we did it because there wasn't a guideline that everyone used. And so we went through all of the various guidelines and all of the elements of them and did a literature search of all of those. And then we came back as a group and that we chose them. And I think one of the things that was really important was at that time we included surgeons, residents, nurses, anesthesiologists, we had physiotherapists and dietitians, et cetera. And I think that really was important. And I have to say that when I think about implementation, I think that the most important things are the culture of things and also ensuring that all of the stakeholders are involved. I think if you don't include the stakeholders right from the start so that they feel that there's some ownership, that it will be difficult. So as you can see here, we had three subgroups. One was the nurses and other allied caregivers, and they developed the guidelines based on the evidence that we found for patient mobility, education, and feeding them, etc. The anesthesiologists developed a guideline for pain management as well as for fluid management in the OR. And then the surgeons that we had together, that they developed the other guidelines. Of course, we all came together and we then went through them so that everyone agreed to them. The second, assessing the current status, and we did an audit, and we had no money when we were doing this. I mean, literally, we had no money. So our best thing was to hire two medical students so that we can sort of pay them slave amount of money. And so we did a just a chart review of the 8 hospitals and 50 charts that we looked at. And this was really important because I think one of the things that you need to know is sort of, is there a gap in care? And because these were a chart, a retrospective chart analysis, that it's probably not really true to fact, but I think that it was enough to show that there was we could do much better, particularly since there were 4 hospitals that said, oh, that we've already implemented ERAS at our hospitals. And you can see that we did well with taking out or not using NG tubes, but that was about the only thing we did well on. We left catheters in too long. We had we did not have any intraoperative fluid restriction and fasting. Still back on being NPO for 8 hours. So here we thought that this was important to show people that there was a gap in care. The next thing is to assess enablers to knowledge use. And in this, we actually looked at barriers as well as enablers. And we, again, got medical students to do a survey, and so we surveyed three nurses, three surgeons, and three anesthesiologists at all of the hospitals. And you can see here that there were some real themes that came out. Recommendations need to be based on strong evidence, something that we felt that was important, and that there must be a multidisciplinary approach to it, and others, as you can see here. And in terms of barriers, there were concerns about lack of institutional resources, nursing culture, as well as physician preferences. And in fact, one thing that I haven't said here, but the last question we asked on this survey was, do you think that we can implement this in our hospitals? And the nurses all said, oh, sure, that this is easy for us and we believe in this, but you'll never get the surgeons or the anesthesiologists to change. And when we asked the anesthesiologists, they of course said, oh yes, this is really important, but you'll never get the nurses and the surgeons to change. And similarly, the surgeons said, oh yeah, we're there, but the others aren't. And again, I'm a broken record on this, but getting people involved right at the start is really important. So then we went on. The next portion is select, tailor, and implement interventions. And we had, as I mentioned, physician involvement right from the start. When we expanded and we had the 15 hospitals that, and we had some funding that we received, that we had a surgeon, an anesthesiologist, and a nurse as champions at all of our hospitals. And you can see here that I wanted to just point out the importance of physicians. They play a very important role because of them being opinion leaders, teachers, and usually well-respected. From a Cochrane review, that their studies have shown that about a 10% absolute increase in compliance with guidelines with physicians involved. And you might say, well, that's really not very good, but if you look at all implementation strategies, audit and feedback, education, et cetera, virtually all of them increase compliance with guidelines or whatever outcome by about 10%. How to engage physicians? They must believe that it's clinically relevant, there's a gap in care, have a sense of ownership, and must see positive results. And again, I feel that was a really important thing, that we involve them right from the start. For our 15 hospitals then, and we had the nurses, a nurse, surgeon, and anesthesia champion that we expected, and they all did develop communities of practice at their hospitals so that they met on a regular basis. And this also was really important. Factors associated with high-performing systems, I put this in. Braithwaite is a health researcher, a health services researcher in Australia, and he's written, he's very prolific. And he came, a recent paper that he showed that factors associated with high-performing systems must have high, have good senior management support, positive organizational culture, effective leaders, proficient workforce, interdisciplinary teamwork, expertise and evidence-based practice, and effective performance monitoring. And that's really our expectation of the champions at each of the hospitals. In addition, we also could note, I should mention that with this grant that we got from the province of Ontario, one of the things that one of the conditions was that the CEO of the hospital had to sign off that they were supportive of this project. And we could tell that some of the senior management at some hospitals were much more supportive than at others. We did a whole bunch of other things. We developed a patient education book. We thought that was really important. If we wanted patients to go home 3 to 4 days after their operation, that they needed to understand that. And so we spent a lot of time on that. We did a video. We had multiple clinical tools. Some of them I've put in here. We had standardized orders, clinical pathways. We had contingency plans so that if there was a problem with thoracic epidurals and with taking out catheters, that we had contingency plans. And we engaged the residents. We recognized they were really important in all of this. We developed a app with our guidelines on it, and we did a lot of resident teaching. And then we, none of the hospitals at that time were on, were NISQIP hospitals, and so we used a lot of the money that we got to develop a huge data collection or database, and the funding that we received, we gave, we could pay for a data collector at all of the hospitals. We had process and outcome measures, and we sent reports to the each of the hospitals every at 3 monthly intervals. And we sent them in 2 different ways. So this is just for the use of lidocaine, but you can see that we named the hospitals A to O, and that we would send them this for all of the various things that we were measuring, and so that they could compare their work compared to others. And in fact, it was interesting that you can see that we here blinded them, and quite quickly that they said, you know, just tell us who's who, even if we're the lowest. And we developed quite a community of practice for the whole group, so that one hospital, say for instance G, which was using lidocaine on 90% of patients, would talk to hospital C about what they were doing to get to that level. We also sent them this so that over time that they could see how they were doing, with blue being the overall rate and the red being each of the individual hospitals. So how well have we done? And I'm not going to go into this. We did decrease the length of stay by 1 day. I was very disappointed at that. We went from 5 days down to, or 6 days down to 5 days. But when we showed this to the CEOs of the hospital in Ontario, we do about 14,000 colorectal resections each year. And so they said, you know, 1 day and 14,000 patients, that is very good. And we had no increase in readmissions. But I think that what this really shows is that we had about 18 months to 2 years where we had funding for this. And it really means, or what I, the takeaway is that you can't implement things in 18 to 24 months. It really takes years to have it completely implemented. Patient satisfaction was high. We did a survey of patients. And then we also interviewed the three champions at all of the hospitals at the end of our 24 months with our grant. And I think that we got some other questions, but I think these comments really say a lot of things about it. And in particular, that in this first one and most of them, I can't remember how many different professions that we counted up. I was so impressed with the contributions from, say, pharmacy and dietary, things that I just wouldn't have thought about before. And I respect their other professions greatly. And I think the best thing, and the probably the thing that's where we've made the big difference, is changing the culture. And here's another one as well. So what are our lessons learned? Well, I think in terms of ERAS, that programs are much more than just feeding patients post-operatively on day one and then throwing them out of bed and then 2 days later throwing them out of the hospital. Secondly, we should focus on the enhanced recovery and not the decreased length of stay. That may be important to us, length of stay, but it's not for patients or anyone else. There's a lot of dogma, and it can be overcome. I think that's why we need to base things on evidence and also measure things. There must be collaboration and engagement of patients, families, and all members of the perioperative team. And I think one thing that we didn't do, where we had all of the providers involved, we did not have any patients or caregivers on our team, and I think that was really, we could have learned much more from the patients. Patient education is essential, system changes are necessary, performance must be measured, and it takes a long time to implement and sustain it. Where we've gone, as I mentioned, our grant was for 2 years. Most of our hospitals now are NISQIP hospitals, and so that we're collecting data through that and trying to, in not as quite as a big way, but to support the community of practice. So I'll just end and show this knowledge to action cycle again. And I think that it probably is similar to most implementation frameworks, but I'd agree with our previous speakers that you need to think about things and not just do them at the last minute or when you think about it. So thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you to each of our panelists and Dr. McLeod. We have ample time for questions, and I think we've heard from three leaders in the field so far. And I know I suspect there's many in the audience who could leverage some of the information they've heard here in their own work. So people have questions. There's a microphone right over there. Maybe I'll sort of start us off. Dr. McLeod, I was struck in your discussion of timelines in terms of how long this work takes. And it's one thing to, I know, start a project when you're already have an international reputation and you're a named professor at a world-leading institution. You can be a little not so much worrying about the timelines and how quickly things get done because, you can sort of play for the long game. But at the earlier stage of your career, if one is thinking about a first project as a faculty member or even as a fellow or trainee, which of these pieces do you think is most advantageous to chip away at first, whether it's building the team or thinking about the model? Like, where do you start at step one?
I'll have to think about that. I think one thing, though, is that I think that if you are starting your career, I think the most important thing is to have a mentor or someone who can step in at times. I'll just give you an example, and this isn't related to implementation science, but it's what I mean is that when I came on staff, I developed a randomized control trial for Crohn's patients, and we needed more patients than just at Toronto, and so my mentor Zane Cohen said, "Let's go to the Mayo Clinic for the day." I said, "Okay," and when we were there, I presented, and it was obvious that it was mine. Zane never said a word. And the Mayo Clinic, of course, I'm telling you this because they agreed to it. And I think that in implementation science like this, you know, like the projects that you guys are doing and ours, you can't do it without senior management in agreement, because it may take some resources or whatever. And I think that I think that that's where the mentor comes in, and that that person can just sort of make things a little bit easier for someone starting off. So I'm not really answering your question, but I think that that's what's needed.
Great, thank you.
Microphone one.
Hi, this is Rich Freeman from Texas. It's great to see some familiar faces, and also to see some work that got started while I was still at Dartmouth, Florian. It's fantastic. I think one of the really fundamental problems is you all have done great things with funding that has come outside of the clinical revenue stream, right? I mean, maybe I misunderstood some of what you said, but grant-funded or department-fund-supported work. And the problem is, okay, you may have implemented it, you've gone through all those steps, it's been great, you've got results. The sustainability is the problem, because if you added resources that weren't there before, by whatever means, you need to continue those resources, or I guess my question is, in the cases that you've all outlined, did you have to continue those resources, or were they self-sustaining? And if the answer was you had to continue the resources, the question is, where does the funding come after the grant goes away? Because that, in value-based healthcare, that's the fundamental question. You created value, but you have to extract it from the system.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think that's one of the most difficult things. With our grant that we got from the province of Ontario, because what their view was that in the academic hospitals, there's lots of knowledge. We're making knowledge or whatever, and that it wasn't being implemented. And so that's why they had these grants. But they did have as I said, that there was proviso, or that you had to have senior management agreement. So there was just a little bit there, but I agree with you completely. And I think also that grants of a couple of years, they aren't long enough. You know, you need 5 or 10 years or something like that. And the other thing that I was saying to Phil is that I have to say that I really disagree with calling this enhanced recovery after surgery, like it's, you know, some sort of magic thing. To me, it's just good management of our patients. And when we start calling it like that, like it's a project, this is our ERAS project, then the day it stops, or, you know, the funding, then it's off the table. And so we really tried actually to communicate with, or get the people at the different hospitals to communicate with their senior management throughout this and keep them up to date as to what we were doing. And then I think the other thing is, and it may not be quite as much here, but I think it probably is, you know, that if you decrease your wound infection rate in the hospital and they go home, all our patients go home on home care, but even though that the home care and the hospital are paid for by our government, the bottom line for home care is not in the hospital budget. And so there's no incentive for the hospital to put money into, let's decrease, they say they do, but they don't, you know, to decrease wound infections, because they're not going to. Yes, so I agree with you completely. It's one of the hardest things, that sustainability.
Maybe I'll ask Dr. Schreck to comment on Dr. Freeman's question, though, because, you know, I think he nicely alluded to is, how do you give this legs across more than one particular project or grant funding application? Because I know both Florian and Ben have strategized around that. You guys want to comment?
Yeah, so, I mean, from my perspective,
this is happening in the VA system right now, which is a little bit of a different animal. The focus of most of the research implementation science projects in the VA, there's always a substantial focus on cost evaluation. And so obviously it's somewhat different in the VA, but ultimately I think the principle is the same. If you can show, like in my case, for example, 3/4 of the low-risk patients get more procedures than they need to, which obviously costs money. If you can, even if you need some amount of resources to decrease that, if those resources cost less, then the extra care that you're quote-unquote wasting, then I think there can be a relatively strong argument to the hospital administrators and the operational people to ultimately down the road shift funding for some of these measures that you may need for sustainability to operational funds and say, well, if we can keep this whatever IT intervention going or can keep feeding back results to providers, it's going to cost a small chunk of money, but we save more. So that's one possible approach.
Yeah, and with our project, we were actively thinking about, we'd gotten a 3-year grant to put together this this TPS program, but within the first 6 months, we were thinking about how to basically get money from the director of the Salt Lake City VA and make this more of an operational project. And so we recently went to them after enrolling 200 patients, and we were able to do sort of a pre-post analysis showing that 14% of patients had come through with the same sort of surgical cohort. The previous 2 years, there was about a 14% rate of patients that were on chronic opioids, 3 months after their surgery. And in the first 200 patients, the first 6 months of our program, we were able to show that there was a 0% rate of that happening. And so they were like, oh my gosh, we want to fund this. So they immediately gave us money to hire people that would basically take the place of the grant when the grant, ended. So I think, data talks, and for all these projects, if you can show data and take it to your operational partner or C-suite people, I think they will start to believe that these are programs that need to be sustained over time. So,
Dr. Huang.
Yeah, hi, Lian Huang from University of Utah. I had two questions for the panel, if you guys can address. The first is, as a young faculty member trying to do a lot of this work, I was wondering if you can comment on. We often hear about the success stories at these panels, or let's say at the Academy of Health conference on dissemination and implementation science, and we don't necessarily hear about failures. So comments from the panel about, in many ways it's nice to say we're going to build these structures in at the beginning of these projects, but particularly, for example, for junior faculty trying to build these in with these long time frames. How does that work, and how much of this is really so clean, right, as much as we want to say, like, oh, look, we fit it in perfectly in this model that, for example, Ben presented, and how much of it is, if you will, somewhat retrospective, and a lot of these efforts often are occurring in parallel rather than sort of in sequence, like as much as we'd like to do it from a scientific standpoint. The second comment, I guess, or question I'd ask is, how does this fit in settings that are less resource have less resources? So, for example, a lot of these projects that have studied implementation are done in academic centers or academic networks. And how can we do this in settings that are less or more resource poor or not part of an integrated network?
Anyone want to take that one?
Yeah, so let me maybe talk about the risk for failure. I mean, the project that I'm presenting here, I just got notification a couple of weeks ago that it's going to be funded. So I have no idea whether it will be a failure or not. From a, both from a scientific perspective and from a grantsmanship perspective, though, is I think if you think through the whole process systematically and the different steps that you're going to go through, ideally you want to set up the project that regardless of what you will find, you will have new knowledge that will allow you to take the next step. So even let's say we develop some strategies and they fail, meaning risk-aligned surveillance for bladder cancer is not going to get better, well, hopefully we'll have some data from our evaluation that gives us some insight in why this may be and what else do we need to tweak to actually get to where we want to get to.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Lee Spengler from Birmingham. My question is for Dr. Shuck and for Dr. Brook. The VA can be somewhat of an opaque system even for those who work within it, and were, in your courses of research, any factors within the VA system that were more assistive or prohibitive to being able to do some of your implementation work? And particularly, Ben, in your case, you worked more with some of the health information technology. Are there built-in tools in that regard, or was that more custom-developed specific to your project exclusively?
Yeah, I mean, that was more of a custom-built thing, and fortunately, our VA is really the informatics hub. It's where Vinci is based, and there's a lot of resources for doing dashboard development and whatnot. So I recognize that was one of the strengths of my local environment, so I wanted to incorporate it. But I also feel like those sorts of tools should be, you know, hand in hand with our implementation strategies for a lot of projects, because it really does help organize a lot of the clinical workflow that goes along with them. You know, the VA is traditionally been a very supportive environment for doing implementation. I mean, VA is known for their query network. And you know, they did have a little bit of a dip recently because query was defunded momentarily during to get money for the choice program, which then ended up being a complete disaster, and they realized that they needed to then switch money back. But you know, hopefully query is now on better footing, and it will be a good mechanism for supporting and funding VA investigators for implementation science, because it really is a nice framework. And at the Surgical Outcomes Club implementation panel, at least one of the investigators there was a VA-funded investigator who received query funds, and he gave a nice kind of outline. And query actually has its own implementation framework that they, you know, that basically gives you kind of a step-by-step process for doing implementation science. So I think if you're within the VA and you tap into that, it's actually a fairly easy, facilitated process.
I had a question. Paul Hazer from Brookdale Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. First of all, thanks. This is all very new to me. I wondered, for Dr. Brook and Shuck, can you guys crisscross, since you're both at VAs? How easy is that to do? Or is this a manpower thing that would, or woman power thing that would take too much to do? Or what's the process if that were to be the case? And I would maybe pass it then to Dr. McLeod about how easy would the ERAS, if it works, be to go to another province? I've been working out in Moncton, and I wondered how translatable is that, or is this really just focused for the time of the grant or the study?
So I think this gets at the problem of, you know, scalability. And so I think from the pure research perspective, we are at least in the earlier stages, like I'm in, and probably you're in too. We're in a more, still, I mean, it's still a lot more messy than a controlled trial, but it's still a somewhat controlled environment where we want to understand, you know, what is the context, what are the problems, how do the strategies work. But ultimately, I think the goal is to develop an implementation strategy or a set of strategies that can be disseminated and are scalable more widely. And again, that gets into the issue of like transitioning then from the research funding to the really operational rollout. Now, since the VA is like a broad integrated system, theoretically, let's say the grant is successful and this works in 6 hospitals, and then we are successful in convincing the leadership, then there could be, you know, national buy-in to roll it out at every VA hospital, potentially. But there is, you know, several steps along the way to get there.
One of the points of my presentation was to discuss that there are a lot of different models, and there really is a continuum or a spectrum between implementation and dissemination, and sometimes the words are used interchangeably, but they really are different. And so one model that's good for implementation within, you know, our Salt Lake City VA might be useful for that setting. It might be, I could use the same model for if I was going to the White River Junction VA, but if I wanted to then say I want to disseminate this to a much, you know, different VAs across the country, I would probably want to look more at a dissemination model and try to, you know, use that sort of structure or framework versus the implementation ones that we use just for our individual practice setting. So I think part of this is just to say, you know, every time you want to do something new, you know, look to see what models or frameworks can help support your, like, the next strategy you want to accomplish.
Yeah,
We're very happy to have people look at our guidelines or use them. We have a website, bestpracticeinsurgery.ca, and our guidelines are there, and also some of the things that we've developed to our implementation tools are there. And if you want to talk to us, we're happy to do that too.
So I have a related a question that's maybe on the practical or pragmatic side. Really, implementation research is the consummate mixed methods approach. That you have to have a lot of different kinds of expertise to put it together. And you know, just yesterday I was talking to somebody who was studying implementation of a perioperative program and. Has employed an ethnographer to study the change in culture over time during the implementation. It's just an example. But each of the three of you have presented specific projects and the models and the conceptual frameworks that you've used for them, and it's noticeable that they're all different. You have knowledge to action, you've got another conceptual framework, you know, CIFR, et cetera. The question is, you know, for the research that we do that's a, you know, database-based research, we develop cores of people who do biostatistics, data management, study design, and things like that, and that work consistently and can work on multiple projects, and it makes for very efficient database research. For implementation science, is it possible to develop a core that could carry implementation science or studies forward across multiple disciplines, are they so distinct that you have to recreate the team every time?
So, I mean, I think it's definitely possible. I'm not at the level where I would have the breadth of funding to actually establish such a core, but I think the pieces of expertise that are needed are distinct. So there's some, you know, qualitative methods or, you know, ethnography or something along those lines, mixed methods. There's PhDs. I'm working with one of our PhDs is a basically she her job description is she's an implementation scientist. So she has a PhD in health service research and then did a fellowship in implementation science. So there's people who are PhD implementation scientists. And then there's other components that you need, like you need probably some component of informatics, you need some component of quantitative analytics, database, data storage, and all of those. But I think for that, you know, getting all of these together in sort of an implementation science core is definitely possible.
Yeah, my impression is that it's very hard to find people like, you know, you guys have a PhD implementation scientist, but those people are very, they don't just grow on the vine, they're very hard to find. And I know in our institution, they've been actively trying to find implementation scientists that have the core training, you know, both in our VA and in our university side for a couple of years. And it's just, they're very hard people to find, to recruit, to bring aboard. So it's a struggle right now because we need more people that have can talk the language and really work in a collaborative, multidisciplinary, you know, efforts, you know, like what's needed, you know, I mean, within core facilities, as Dr. Fisenlyson mentioned. So,
but Sam, I may not be understanding you. I don't think that we need special people for different projects, so that if you've got, say, someone who does qualitative work, that person probably could help Florian and could also help Ben.
And that's what I'm asking.
But I think that to have, you know, your team, it has to have people with different skills, and I do think that having someone who can do qualitative analysis, I think that's really important. And but I think that you can build up a team and do different things.
Right. Next question.
Gabriel Bratt from Beth Israel Deaconess. You guys did a great job, and thank you so much for these wonderful presentations. One of the questions that I think about in these types of situations and is how to bake in some of the legal issues that are related to this. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts about how you address and take into account and potentially prevent some of the things that create barriers for you to actually implement these within health systems, et cetera, from the very beginning so that this doesn't slow down your work as you move forward.
Anybody want to tackle that?
So I'm not entirely clear. What can you specify the specific legal concern that you're thinking about?
Sorry. So I guess what I'm asking is, in many cases, there are whether it be hospital regulations, protocols that sometimes need to be changed in order to be able to implement this project. And so you work in a milieu of a number of regulations. You can't just drop these implemented projects without actually affecting a large number of people. So my question is, how do you address kind of some of the policy legal ramifications of the work that you're doing from the very beginning to make sure that that is actually facilitated?
Maybe Ben, you know, this sounds like for your opioid changes, you had to work within a context of a bunch of existing rules. So
yeah,
how did you navigate that?
Right. It's ongoing, and it's been very. You bring up a very good point because anytime you try to change, clinical workflow or practices or processes, you really run into a lot of existing protocols and we basically have become part of the VA. There's a pain management committee, and they go over the rules, and we basically just try to make it as integrated as possible within what is already known. But we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel. I mean, we were trying to just basically bring to light that there are guidelines and there are processes that we should be following. But it has been a struggle in that there's been a lot of people who have been somewhat resistant to change, and that's part of our process is to try to, implementation is an iterative process. It's not just like you implement and then you stop. It's you have to refine, you have to, basically establish relationships with your networks and with your practice settings to make it work. So it's kind of a long-winded question or answer, but it's hard to kind of. It is a problem, and we just have to I think individually assess the situation and try to make amends. So
I think though it's a bit variable. There's some people who over the smallest thing can just sort of kill you because they just won't move. But then there's some people who think, who are on side and think that this is the way it should go and are very happy to support people who want to do something. So I think that it's a little bit variable.
Thanks for that question. Dr. McLeod, I've been at Dartmouth for a long time. We've never had anybody there who's small-minded and stuck in their ways. That doesn't happen at all. With that end, I think we're getting towards the end of time. I do want to sincerely thank our panelists here. Maybe let's have a communal round of applause.